You're listening to Ian Stone's Comedy Breakfast, the podcast edition. I'm here on Love Sport Radio every weekday morning at 6:30.
Love Sport.
Well, Eden Hazard was unveiled as Real Madrid's new Galactico, I guess you can say, although he said he wasn't a Galactico, but he'd like to be one day. He then proceeded to kiss the badge. Also in the news related to that, Maurizio Sarri will be the next Juventus manager. We think it's basically been confirmed. And in the US Open at Pebble Beach, Justin Rose leads by one stroke. But some of the big beasts are coming up very close behind. Tiger Woods is, I think, 5 behind. Rory McIlroy, 3 behind. Brooks Koepka, 4 behind. This is the Comedy Breakfast on Love Sport Radio. I'm here with Ross Satar. Good morning, Ross.
Good morning, Ian.
Morning. How are you?
I'm not so bad. Not
good
so bad.
At this unearthly hour of the morning. Thank you very much for coming in. Eden Hazard was unveiled yesterday. What they do is they... I always like the idea of there's like a person under like a sheet, and they pull it off and they go, ta-da! But essentially he walks out. Can we hear, by the way? We do have a bit of audio. Let's hear what he had to say when he was unveiled at Real Madrid yesterday.
I will try to be the best team in the world. Not just the player. It's a different level. I had a lot of success with Chelsea. I want to win a lot with Madrid. So just to be here is a new challenge. But I'm ready for that.
What they do is they sort of wheel him out. He waves. They get people in. Have you seen this?
Yeah.
50,000 people, I reckon.
I saw him taking a selfie with all these, like,
it's great.
Wavy people.
It's great. And I like all that. I quite like it. But it's all a bit self-referential. And he says, "Hala Madrid." He loves Madrid. And we know that he's gone on and on, hasn't he? About
well, yeah,
how much
it's no
he
surprise
loves the
to
club.
Anybody that he's gone. So
no, but more than that, he's expressing his love for the club. He kissed the badge.
I know.
As well. I mean, what do you think about this? You're not. We've never talked about whether you've actually got a football team. Do you have one?
I think we have talked because my dad used to take me to Ipswich. So that scarred me for life, I think.
Right. So you're not, if let's say I'm trying to think of the scenario where an Ipswich legend signed for Norwich, right?
Paul Mariner goes to Norwich.
There's it. Hey, for anyone under 40, Paul Mariner was a bustling centre forward who also played for my lot as well. Played for Arsenal for a while, right? But
yeah.
Let's say that Paul Mariner goes to Norwich and then kisses the badge. Wouldn't be particularly happy.
Well, I was devastated when we went to Arsenal, so, yeah.
All right, so if you'd have kissed the Arsenal badge, you wouldn't have been happy about that.
No. I mean, as much as a nine-year-old could get into a strop, I was just like, right, that's it. He's dead to me.
He is dead to me. He started tearing your clothes.
Rending my garments.
Rending.
Absolutely.
Rending is exactly the word I was looking for, right? So, look, I don't actually care that Eden Hazard kisses the badge. He can kiss the badge. I wouldn't care less. I mean, I remember this. My son was about 7, 8, 9 maybe, and he used to talk about wanting to be a professional footballer. And I said, well, what happens if you play for Tottenham? You know, I had this recurring dream where he played for Tottenham and he scored the winning goal against Arsenal and then ran in front of the Arsenal fans kissing the Tottenham badge. And I say, I'd have to have you adopted at that point, right? I couldn't possibly be in the same
house. You told him that,
yeah. I told him this. Yeah, no, he understands. We have quite a high level of bants, all right? He's the son of a comedian. He has to get used to it, all right? So I'm saying, does it matter that they kiss the badge?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's all part and parcel of the unveiling. Although when you say unveiling, I had like visions of him being like draped under a neck curtain or something.
And they open
then they
it up. They open it up. We present to you Eden Hazard. Steps out from the curtain like stars in their eyes.
Yeah.
A bit of dry
tonight,
ice.
Matthew, I'm going to be
Eden Hazard. Eden or Eden?
I was calling him Eden Hazard.
I reckon Garden of Eden, Eden Hazard is what I'm saying. I don't know.
Let's call him Hazard and be happy with it.
Yeah. Anyway, he kissed the badge and you're not bothered? You wouldn't be bothered by that?
I wouldn't be bothered. I mean, I think it's part and parcel of the whole hullabaloo that goes with the signings and stuff. I mean, back in the day, you know, it would be like holding up a t-shirt and that would be it.
Yeah.
But now it's like a public event. So, you know, I think you just...
It used to be a press conference. It used to be. I remember when Arsene Wenger signed Sol Campbell. That was the big one because no one knew who it was going to be. He was basically hidden behind the screen, and out he steps, and everyone went, "What?" But that is unusual, and these things these things don't... Generally, you can't keep these things quiet. Let's be fair. This we've known this one has been on for about...
A season.
A season. He's been going on about it. As for the Real Madrid fans themselves, are they the most entitled up their own backside fans in the history of football fans?
They certainly have passion. Let's just leave it at that.
Come on.
No, I think all fandoms have that kind of extremism that comes with just being totally in love with their football side.
Yeah,
but do they take it too far?
Do they? Yeah, but I mean, basically, they booed Zidane when he played there. They booed Ronaldo.
It's a demanding lot,
clubbed legend, and they booed Gareth Bale in the last few months, particularly. But it doesn't take a lot for them to turn.
Yeah.
That's the point. There could be 50,000 of them turning out for Eden Hazard, and then they suddenly, you know, 6 months later, if he doesn't have a good performance,
exactly.
If he puts in a season like he did for Chelsea 3 years ago, when he basically didn't kick the ball for 9 months, they will be right on him.
Yeah.
They will be right on him. They were also, by the way, singing Mbappe's name because they're at the unveiling of Eden Hazard. He didn't seem to take it too badly. But
so that lasted for all of about 5 minutes.
Yeah,
then.
Oh, we love you. We love you. You're amazing.
Mbappe.
Look at her over there. It's that, right? It's outrageous.
It's that meme, isn't it?
It's that meme. If you haven't seen the meme, it's a bloke with a woman and he's looking at another woman's behind, right?
That's Real Madrid.
That is Real Madrid fans' heads turned. Except Real Madrid in that meme, they would be, the original couple, the man and woman, will be walking down the aisle in their wedding, and he'll be looking at a girl's behind as he's walking down. Oh, she's all right, isn't she? And of course, love her and cherish Dubai and all that. Yeah. So, they can turn quite quickly. By the way, has anyone asked the question where they're getting all this money, Real Madrid? Because they bought Jovic, they have bought a couple of other players, they bought Eden Hazard, which is 88, rising to 130 or whatever it is.
130 million.
And they're talking about Mbappe, and three words, financial fair play.
Yeah.
Where is all this money coming from? Have they sold another training ground to the Spanish government? Or is that what they've done? They've written off another £500 million worth of debts.
Possibly. I mean, do they come under the same? I suppose they must do, really, because it's a FIFA's...
It's a UEFA thing. It's financial fair play. And of course they do. Listen, essentially, they're owned by the Spanish government, right?
Yeah.
To all intents and purposes. And it is the Spanish government team. But it's not fair, is it? They shouldn't be able to buy all these Galactico players.
No. But money talks.
Yeah, I know, but hang on a minute. I mean, Man
City... Where
do
they get... Yeah.
Chelsea have been banned for two transfer windows. I'm just actually looking. Andy's just giving me a headline. Real Madrid must make more than £250 million in player sales to meet financial fair play regulations.
Wow.
Gareth Bale and Mateo Kovacic could be leaving. So what? They're basically spending money... Thanks, Andy. They're spending money and then they're basically going to have to make sure they sell players. Gareth Bale has to go.
Yeah.
Has to go in this particular case.
I think so.
It doesn't seem fair to me, but you know what? We'll see if it works out. So far, they've spent a fortune. If they get Mbappe in, Mbappe is going to cost the best part of £200 million. They're going to have to sell the stadium.
Yeah, well, their results are going to have to speak for themselves. But, I mean, did you say Bale and somebody else? Who else is going to go?
Bale, Kovacic, there'll probably be a couple of others as well who they'll have to ship out in order to be able to afford these players. But I thought the general rule with this is that you sell the players before you buy the other players.
And not the other way around.
Well,
it's like robbing Peter to pay Paul, isn't it? Really?
Well, yeah, quite. I mean, they're miles behind Barcelona, so they're a bit desperate. They lost the league by a lot of points. But I don't really care. What about the regulations? I mean, we've got all these revelations from Der Spiegel, from the German newspaper, about Manchester City, and they're talking about throwing them out of the Champions League. Let's see if they throw out Real Madrid if they overspend, and then we can talk. Anyway, they might be selling Keylor Navas, the goalkeeper, Lucas Silva, Bale, Kovacic, amongst, they're saying, 13 players who could leave. And they're going to have to sell all of them in order to afford Mbappe, as far as I can see. We'll talk a little bit about the Women's World Cup is continuing. Are you watching the Women's World Cup?
A little bit here and there.
I'm dipped in and out so far. I've seen a couple of big games, a couple of full games and bits and pieces of quite a few of the others. wasn't that impressed with Brazil against Australia yesterday, but they're not great teams. And Emma Hayes has written a piece in The Times, I believe it is today, about maybe they should think about slightly smaller goals, smaller pitches. We can have a little chat about that in a moment.
This is Love Sport.
Joined by Paris McCauley for a very good reason. there was no one else available. Hello, aww. Paris. Good morning.
Morning.
Can we have Paris's microphone on? That'd be very good. That was a joke, by the way, Paris. Comedy breakfast.
Yeah, all right. If you say so.
Oh, dear, we've got off on the wrong foot, haven't we? The reason that Paris has come in, because there's a... Yeah, that's right, there's some chocolate there. Ross bought some chocolate, and it's very nice. The reason, I think it's a bit early for that sort of stuff, I've got to be honest with
you. It's never too early for chocolate, Ian.
I'm just saying. Ever. I mean, you know, when you get to a certain age and one has to really watch what one eats.
One really watches.
One does.
Sorry, there was a bit too much of that, wasn't there? Even halfway through that sentence, I thought,
I was having flashbacks.
Absolute arse.
I thought I was back in Surrey again.
Yeah. I've never spoken like that in my life. Anyway, there's a discussion. Emma Hayes has written a piece in The Times today about the Women's World Cup. And about whether they should seriously think about smaller goals, possibly smaller pitches. I mean, this is an ongoing discussion. Ciara Walsh, the England player who's been talking about the World Cup, had some interesting comments to say about the quality. Let's hear what she had to say.
It's been quite probably a slow start to this World Cup. I think other than France, I would say that our first half we played some fantastic football, and I think if we can take that and, as I said, sustain it throughout longer periods of a game, then, you know, there's no reason why we can't do what we've set out to do.
Yeah. Now, that is not necessarily about the size of the pitches or the size of the ball or anything like that. It's just saying that it hasn't been that good. Now, tournaments do sometimes start quite slowly. Emma Hayes has written this piece in The Times talking about whether the pitches should be smaller and also about the goals, because the average height of a goalkeeper in a women's game is, what, 5'8"? Average height of a goalkeeper in a men's game, 6'3" in the Premier League. 7-inch difference there. Now, you've been involved, Paris, in women's football at various levels, and you disagree with Emma Hayes, do you not?
I do. I when you look at it, you go, Emma Hayes, who's achieved so much in the game, like as a coach.
Very well respected by both the men and the women at Chelsea.
I'm less respected in the women's game.
It doesn't matter. You have an opinion and that's fine.
She's saying make the goals smaller, this, you know, make the pitch smaller, fine. But you've got to keep in mind also that women's football was banned in this country for a long time. So you've got the development issue. So they've not had the same development as men's football. At all.
That's true.
They've had not the same facilities. They've not had the same backing.
Okay.
I don't think it's necessarily about the size of the goals or the pitch.
All right. Putting aside the ridiculous thing that we banned women's football for 50 years, and that is obviously a nonsense, and they have got a bit of catching up to do. If your average goalkeeper, let's say you have two goalkeepers, a man and a woman, one of whom is 5'8" and one of whom is 6'3", they, and with the same... essentially the same physicality in terms of being able to jump and do what they do, doesn't it make sense that a woman goalkeeper is going to be less likely to save shots than a male goalkeeper? Doesn't it?
Yeah, you would think that it would exponentially work that way. But, I mean, is this a rearguard reaction to this whole 13-0?
She said it wasn't. The Thai goalkeeper is 5'5". Quite a lot of the goals were scored from inside the area anyway. I think the other thing to say about that argument also is that maybe women's shots are not quite as powerful as men's shots, so the goalkeeper will have more time to shift across. I mean, Paris, it's just a physical thing. Isn't it?
There is a physical thing, but also you've got to keep in mind that 13-0, Thailand are the worst team ranked in this competition, and the difference between the top and the bottom ranked team in a competition is so much bigger on the women's side at the moment than it is on the men's. Thailand cannot defend. That was a contributing factor to losing 13-0. The keeper pulled off some good saves. Yes, 5-5. A couple might have been lobs. I don't think there was, you know, it's 13-0, fine, you know, fine, you got that. But Emma Hayes, of course, has been speaking about this before the World Cup.
She said it wasn't a reaction to the Thailand game.
No, right.
And I don't think it is. I think it's just worth noting. I said to you that I felt that there was a lack of intensity in some of the games. Not actually in the England-Scotland game.
No.
Well, that was quite an intense match. But
that was the first one that I watched end-to-end.
And it was a decent game.
I thought it was a decent game.
It was. But you know, when you think about other sports, I mean, women's tennis plays three sets instead of five. The women say, I mean, you know about this, Ross, the women say that they could play five sets, but TV won't schedule games for that long. There are other examples, aren't there? I mean, the women, we were talking about hurdling, weren't we?
Yeah, yeah.
Men do, you used to be a hurdler. So the men used to do
110, and I think their hurdles are 3 inches higher than the women's hurdles.
Isn't it just the same as that, Paris?
Yeah.
Isn't it just the same?
Well, tennis, why don't we make these service boxes bigger so that women can hit harder serves so they don't have to concentrate too much on that?
Why don't we? I mean, we are essentially different physical beings, men and women.
But the difference is women's tennis hasn't been banned for a long time in this country, so women were playing on the normal size courts. And I think if the issue is that, you know, women have been starting playing on big size pitches, because why wouldn't you, then to bring it down to the smaller is going to be different. Whereas I think we were talking about it before we came on air, if you had smaller pitches to begin with, then it wouldn't be such a stretch, I think.
Right. It's the fact that we're looking at it and going, well, it's not as good as the men's game, so why don't we try and change it to make it better? And I don't think it's about that. I just think that you're just looking purely at the physicality. What I said to you, Paris, when I came in this morning is I watched a bit of that Brazil-Australia game, and I've watched quite a bit of some of the other games, and there is a lack of intensity to me. And I think the size of the pitch definitely makes a difference to that.
Well, we might as well play five-a-side then. You always get intensity in a five-a-side game. Should we turn the women's game into five-a-side?
No, I would say you turn it into 11-a-side with a pitch which is maybe 2 yards. I mean, essentially, you have a maximum and a minimum size pitch anyway.
Yeah.
And I think the tighter the pitch, the more intense the game is in the men's game. So why couldn't you just say, well, the women play on the minimum size pitch? Just as simple as that. It's still a regulation pitch. It's just a minimum size because it suits the women's physicality better.
So it might say that, but also there might be a team that want to play wide, expansive football. So therefore, they're not going to narrow their pitch. That was the thing with the minimum and maximum, is that you set your pitch up in a certain way to suit your style of play. If your style of play is not high intensity, you know, like if we come to the men's game, you know, you referenced Liverpool versus Man City earlier, saying, the intensity in that game. You go, yeah, fine. I watched Fulham versus Cardiff last season, men's game. No intensity whatsoever.
Not a particularly high-intensity game.
No one was saying, let's make the pitch smaller. Let's bring them all together, shall we? I think what you've got to understand is when we've chatted with Ella German this week a great deal is that the men's and women's games are different.
Yeah.
It's the same sport. But it's different, and you've got to do different things in those games. And the thing is, the women's game is not going to be all about power and pace necessarily. It's about technical ability. And lots of these players have the technical ability. Yes, not all of them are necessarily going to be able to hit 75-yard passes. They can't all in the men's game either.
There are more turnovers in the women's game as well, which would actually suggest less technical ability. But that is down to 50 years of missing football, is it not?
Yeah.
To a certain extent.
If you look at the Premier League maybe, 20-odd years ago, you've got the types of players you've got in there compared to the types of players you've got now. You had your big lumps of centre-forwards who you hoof the ball up to. You're bound to lose the ball half the time. In the women's game, you've got teams like...
It's on the floor.
It's on the floor. You've got to try and, you know, in the women's game now, you're looking at teams, what Emma Hayes has done with Chelsea, what the Man City coach has done with Man City, what Arsenal are doing now in WSL. They are streaks ahead of everyone else. Streaks ahead of everyone
else.
And then you've got England and the USA, like, playing in the She Believes Cup. Great football. High intensity because they want the game. England versus Scotland, there's always going to be a high intensity because it's England versus Scotland.
You know what? You make very good points. Can I just read what Emma Hayes said in the last paragraph of this? We are experiencing better coaching, more funding and enhanced development across the world, and I want to explore how we can keep improving. Constructive debate should be encouraged. I don't want to see men called sexist for daring to discuss how the women's game is different. The facts are that in all sorts of little ways, it is. We should be able to discuss why that might be good and bad. As you said to me, Paris, you said, and as Paul Mortimer, who sat here the other day, said to me, you can't watch it thinking that it's the same product.
No.
But at the same time, you should be able to watch it and go, how can this be tweaked to make it better? If you made the goal a foot less wide, maybe that would work. I don't know. We're not talking about stopping women playing.
No,
we're just
no.
trying to change the game to make it the best product possible.
Say, for instance, you've got a 6'7" tall woman, which you know, does happen, believe it or not. You know,
Gwendolyn Christie from Game of Thrones is in goal for one of the teams, right?
Exactly.
She has to do
of a sudden now, should we make the goals bigger again? You know, it's like you've got goalkeepers, like, you know, if you go back in time, male goalkeepers who were, 5'8", 5'7", 5'9", you didn't ask to make the goals smaller then. I think it would be a huge step backwards.
A retrograde step. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are saying that, but I think Emma Hayes should be listened to, because Emma Hayes is a very well-respected coaching figure in men's and women's football, and it's worth having the discussion. Well, we've had it.
We've had it.
There you go. Thank you, Paris. It's 6:53. Me and Ross Sattar here. Maurizio Sarri is going to be the new Juventus manager. Well, he didn't last long.
Surprise of nobody.
No, he didn't last long, did he? Last year, Chelsea had meant to be having this sort of new stability, but he won the Europa League, got to the final of the Carabao Cup, got third in the in the league, and yet he's off.
He started okay.
Started very well, 20 games unbeaten or something like that.
And then suddenly it all really unravelled, and you know, he seemed to lose. I think once you lose the respect of the players, which with the whole sort of keeper debacle. He just lost it.
Do you think
completely?
That was the moment in the Carabao Cup final when he couldn't get his goalkeeper to come off the pitch?
For me, that definitely was, because he just seemed to have lost the plot completely. And I think it's good that he stopped himself from stomping off into the dressing room.
He did have a proper strop, though, didn't he?
He certainly did. I mean, it would put any good toddler to shame. But, you know, if he disappeared through those doors, I think that would have been the end of him before the end of the season.
Well, I sat here on a number of occasions saying he's going to get the sack, he's going to get the sack. There is no way
he's
staying.
So he's obviously jumping before he does that.
Yeah. This was back in, I don't know, November, December. Yeah. They were in quite a bad place. Well, they're in a bad place. But he stuck it out. They got through. As I said, they won the Europa League. They got third in the Premier League. They had a good season, even though my Chelsea mate said it was one of the worst seasons they've ever watched. I mean, that's the truth of it. They were complaining bitterly from start to finish. But he did well. But it always felt like he was a dead man walking.
Yeah, I thought he started well, and I thought, right, for once they're going to have a bit of stability here. But for me, it seemed like Abramovich just got bored of him and bored of Chelsea.
Well, I'm Abramovich. He wasn't sacked, by the way. He wasn't sacked. Yeah. Abramovich, by the way, is also... Abramovich has his own issues because he can't get...
He can't get a visa.
A passport to get into the country, right? He's so he has issues. One of the only games he went to was the Europa League final, I think. But generally, he hasn't been around very much. But Maurizio Sarri, he didn't have to leave.
No.
He didn't have to, but I think he just didn't feel very supported.
And I think it's beginning to look like Chelsea's a poison chalice.
Well, poison chalice that won another trophy. They've won three European trophies in 7 years.
Isn't that the very definition of a chalice?
No. What? No, a very definition of a chalice. A chalice is like a cup.
Well, there you go.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Do you see where I'm going
Do you know
with
what?
This?
A cup, I suppose it is. It is a poisoned cup. Well,
and there you
they
go.
Didn't win a poisoned cup. They won the Europa League, which might as well be a
How many
poisoned...
more people have died?
I don't know. No one was drinking from the cup. I know.
No,
is that...
but, you know, if you're going to come in and manage Chelsea, are you going to have another job lined up for the next season?
Well,
because that's what it feels like.
Like I say, they tried for a bit of stability. If Frank Lampard comes in, and that looks like there's a lot of talk about Frank Lampard coming in, he is a Chelsea legend. They might stick with him for longer than the season. But the truth is, I don't know, lose 8 games in a row and he'll be gone as well.
Exactly.
I mean, that's how it goes. And losing Eden Hazard is a big loss for them. Anyway, we'll discuss that.
Love sports.
It's freezing in this studio, by the way. I am really cold. I'm sitting here. You've got...
I know. You could legitimately hide a body in here. It's that cold.
Yeah. Well, it is chilly. But anyway, you've turned the air conditioning off now. Thank you very much. It's the comedy break. I know it's meant to be summer, but it is. We had the heating on the other day.
Oh, I've had the heat. Since I got back from France, I've had the heating on. The first thing I did when I got in, because it was torrential rain all the way home. It took me ages to get home.
Well, it's not right, is all I'm saying. I mean, listen, if the global warming wants to kick in, I'm happy for it to happen in this studio right now. It's the comedy breakfast on Love Sport Radio. Obviously, I'm worried for my children. You understand? I don't really want it. I'm all with you, climate extinction people. people out there, but honestly, I'll tell you what my mum said to me. My mum's hilarious. The Climate Extinction people were out on the bridge, and she went, oh, at least the weather was nice for them. Bless her. Bless her. No, well, yes, mum. Yeah, that's
not
true.
The point.
That isn't really the point. Anyway, it's the Comedy Breakfast on Love Sport Radio. Let's have a chat about the golf. England's Justin Rose hit a course record equaling 65 to take a one-shot lead at the US Open Golf. The world number four is on 6 under par after the first round at Pebble Beach. Rose admits Tiger Woods' record was on his mind.
I was playing the last hole, and obviously after the bunker shot, I was like, this is kind of similar putt. So, and it was nice to do it, obviously, in front of the man himself, but that's just a nice little side note, really. It wasn't, you know, the start is more important than that.
I mean, that's the thing. He's playing with Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods has had the most amazing round in golf, or the most amazing four rounds in golf history at the US, the US Open in 2000. He's finished 15 shots clear of the entire field. And Justin Rose is walking around the same course, hitting a great round with Tiger Woods playing with him. You've got to feel the weight of history in these moments, haven't you?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, you know, I was having a look at the odds before it all kicked off, and, you know, Rose wasn't, you know, had ridiculously high odds.
We didn't really even talk about him in the build-up
yesterday.
I'll tell you what, let's have a chat with the Love Sport golf expert and co-host of the golf show on Love Sport, Jeremy Dowd. Morning, Jeremy.
Morning, Ian.
Nice to speak to you. I mean, we didn't really talk about Justin Rose yesterday, but he was on fire, wasn't he?
Well, he hasn't been in form, so no wonder. He's had a bit of an average year so far, but hot putter, birdied the last three holes, eagle the sixth, and hit 22 putts. So that'll cover a lot of long game mistakes, which he has been making, actually, which is unlike him. You associate him with, you know, smooth rhythm, fairways and greens. But you can't argue with 65, and equaled the best score at, in a year certain at Pebble Beach ever.
Well, okay then. He did very, very well. And he was talking about how with Tiger Woods walking around, and he knows what Tiger Woods has done on that course in 2000 and subsequently as well. And he was aware of what was happening.
Yes, I mean, he had much easier conditions than Woods did. And obviously, in the intervening time between when Woods won it in the early 2000s, the equipment has come on a bit as well, and the course hasn't changed in length so much. So I'd say Woods' round is probably a better round, because without wind, Pebble Beach is slightly more susceptible. And it's soft as well, so they've had some rain, and that does make it a lot easier for these guys.
Hi. I mean, McIlroy is not known for his sort of quick starts, but three shots behind him, is this feels strange for McIlroy. Good start for him?
Yeah, very good. Whenever he's won a major, he scored in the 60s in the first round, so this is a very good sign, carrying over his form from Canada last week. And he bogeyed the first hole and didn't look terribly convincing, to be honest. Pulled his shot into a left-hand bunker. There was, you know, the Pacific Ocean on the right-hand side, so, and it was 200 yards away, so yeah, fair enough. And it's quite an awkward opening hole. He started on the 10th, but after that he was really really good. And yeah, he needs a good start, I think. He's the kind of player that feeds on momentum, and really pleasing to see him finally contend in a major this year. He's shown great form this year, won the TPC, won in Canada, loads of top tens in the early part of the year, but the majors haven't really been his forte this year in the first two. So hopefully he'll put that right with this one, and he made a great start, obviously.
And Brooks Koepka, the reigning champion, the two-time champion, not really, this course doesn't really suit him, but he's hanging in there, isn't he?
Well, he's 2 under. He's absolutely fine. If you think that 6 under actually is the leading score now, it might well be the winning score. So anybody within, you know, 8 shots of that is well in contention, and Brooks is fine. Anything under par, fantastic, 69 today. Puts him right there. You know, you talk about Rory being in contention. Brooks is only 1 back, and we've got 3 rounds to go. So they're just playing now to get into position. Saturday they'll try and shoot a low score if the conditions allow it, and then obviously Sunday is the nervous day.
And obviously Tiger watch. What did you make of Woods?
Well, scrambling a little bit and
a
scrambling
lot.
Very well.
Scrambling.
1 under, yeah, but he kept it together. He only made 1 double bogey, 3 birdies, and all the rest pars. He made a double at the par 3 fifth, which, you know, has been redesigned by Jack Nicklaus right by the ocean. So, treacherous hole. And they're all treacherous holes. If you hit a wide and you get into that thick rough, then you are in a bit of trouble. And we didn't see a huge amount of that yesterday because there's no wind. If the wind blows this and it firms up, which it will, the USGA will play around with this. They don't like a lot of players shooting under par.
No.
The 39 golfers under par and 18 more on level. So they will fiddle around with this, make it quicker, make the greens crustier.
They can't make firmer. The wind blow, can they?
No, but what are the chances? It's right by the ocean.
It's by the, it's a links course. It's a links course. It's going to happen, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I would imagine that we'll get some weather at some point.
And also, by the way, some of the Brits, I was Tommy Fleetwood, level par. I mean, people keep talking about him as a possible major winner. Do you think he's got a chance in this tournament?
Well, he's only six back. Absolutely. Of course he's got a chance. He does perform well. He performed really well in the last year's US Open. Nearly got close enough to put Brooks under a bit of pressure. 65, I think, in the last round. He shot at Shinnecock. And he is a class act. He's not a big guy, but he does hit it well. I was reading that he has the same sort of fitness routine as Brooks. And these guys are really strong. He might not look really strong, but he's a super player. I mean, he has a major in him for sure. Obviously, nobody knows when that will be, but the US Open does suit him as well. He's long and straight, and he has good nerves, so I think he's got every chance.
Thanks, Jeremy. Nice to speak to you. That's Jeremy Dale there, Love Sport golf expert, co-host of The Golf Show on Love Sport Radio. Jeremy Dale talking about the US Open started yesterday. First round from Pebble Beach on the West Coast.
This is Love Sport.
What did you watch last night? You were telling me.
I decided I wanted to switch my mind off if I was going to get up ridiculously early. So I was watching this B movie called Titanic 2.
Yeah. It was on Movies
Miss
for
Men.
I saw that because I pointed it out to my missus and I said, Titanic 2. I said, who in their right minds would get on a ship called the Titanic? Even after the first one, right? But obviously, 1,500 people did.
You know they're building one, don't you?
It's all right, but it's long enough ago. But anyway, this was set when, Titanic 2?
Oh, yeah, like modern day, so...
All right, 80s, 90s, whatever it was.
Yeah, no, well...
Oh, was it made quite recently?
Yeah, it was like a 2004 film or something.
Titanic 2, and they got back on the ship. Let me guess, it sank again?
It did indeed. I was so shocked.
How
so
unlucky. I can't believe it. God, who'd have thought of a ship called Titanic would go down again?
But the funny thing was, while I was like looking up the plot on Wikipedia, there is a Titanic 2 being built by this Aussie guy that I saw non-stop when I was in Australia this year.
Right.
Who's trying to make Australia great again. So I'll just leave you with that kind of image.
Has he got hats?
He hasn't got hats, but he's about the same size as Donald Trump.
Right.
And probably about as odious. And he's actually in charge of building a Titanic 2. It's running over budget and it's late. It should have been...
These things are unbelievable. You ever been on a cruise ship?
I have.
Yeah, have you?
I have.
I mean, I've been on one. I went on... I did the final crossing of the QE2.
Wow.
From New York to London. It's the only cruise gig I've ever done. And I upset all the Germans on the boat.
Oh, did you? Why doesn't that surprise you?
I know, it was just a bit of fun. It was a bit of fun saying, I'm Jewish and I don't hate the Germans. I miss my grandparents, but I don't hate the Germans. It's a funny joke. Not knowing that all the 70-year-olds in the audience were all German. Who would have known? It's not like they had a name badge or anything, you know? I mean, anyway, so that's what happened. And I thought, I'm never doing a cruise again. But the point about them is they are massive structures, aren't they?
They are huge.
Did you see the one careering into the quay in Venice?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How do they let those cruise ships through Venice? It's a joke.
Yeah, I mean, I've been on one, like when my dad died, my mum and dad had a cruise booked. It was like from Bangkok to Beijing.
Right. That's a hell of a cruise.
It was amazing, but it's full of old people. So I go to Vietnam thinking, great, I can go crawling down the Gook tunnels and, you know, relive Platoon in my mind. And,
the Gook,
you know,
tunnels? Yeah. Is that what they're called?
Yeah, they're called Gook tunnels.
Right.
And, you know, you're not allowed to take, like, old people aren't allowed to go because, like, their hips will fall apart. And you're literally crawling around, like, you know, action man with eagle eyes through these tunnels. And I couldn't actually go on it. Instead, my mum wanted to go to some market. So I had to go to some market in Vietnam. And the whole reason I wanted to go to Vietnam was to go visit the Viet Cong battlegrounds. I was gutted. gutted.
That started quite nicely. That started quite nicely, that story. And then really sort of, you know, it was really quite sad at the end.
It could be worse. I could be on the Titanic too.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. Andy has come in as well, by the way. Andy, hello.
Hello.
Hello. Nice to see you. Now, while we're on the subject of ships sinking, we might as well talk about the Conservative Leadership Contest what's happening to Britain. It's all over the front page, isn't it?
The Sun screams, "We've all been screwed by Boris," which is basically everyone in the leadership race saying that at some point they've been screwed by Boris. If you missed the Tory leadership race, we did lose Esther McVeigh and the other guy that no one can remember.
Mark
the
Harper.
Name of. That's the one, yeah. That's probably
and
why
also,
I lost.
And also Andrea Leadsom as well.
Yeah, which is a little bit of a surprise.
I'm not that shocked, by the way. And I'm also not that shocked.
I thought she'd squeak in as one of the first seven.
Well, I'm not that shocked that the women didn't get through this round, because I think in the end there was no way the Conservatives are going to have another woman after Theresa May. But anyway, so there's seven left.
Boris has got 114 declarations of support, which is almost treble the number of it, the nearest guy behind him.
And Andy, if he gets 114, he is definitely into the last two with that number I was reading yesterday, because with the 313 Tory votes, you can't get two more with more than that. So he is definitely in if he retains his votes.
Certainly. But what has happened in the past, we've had David Davis have a huge lead before. We've had other sort of Tory candidates have huge leads before. And what does happen in the later rounds is that some people then block a sort of anti-Boris vote and they'll just chuck support behind whoever the other person is. And so it does, you can get these incredible swings the other way once people's first choices are taken out of the equation.
What do you think of Boris?
I liked him back in the days when he was like this bumbling buffoon. Do you remember when he was like trying to do, it was a 2012 handover thing and he was dangling by his danglies and everything. Yeah.
Zip line, have I got news for you, Boris?
And even David Cameron was like, you know, and for anybody else, for any other politician, this would just be a death knell, but Boris somehow carries it off. But
it's an act.
It is, exactly. And then when you put him in positions of power, you realise just what a liability, liability
does he
is.
Have? I mean, I don't know what you think. Does he have any principles, any real beliefs at all, aside from him being Prime Minister? That seems to be what it's all about for him.
I mean, it is worth revisiting some of his faux pas. I mean, the picking in his line, the letterboxes about Muslims. He called homosexuals bum boys at one point as well. And you look at some of these spectacular faux pas. As much as you sort of have this sort of lovable sheen that Boris sort of projects, the thing that he sort of says these things and means, but actually means well, surely there's the danger for Boris, especially we're going to have these televised debates coming up, potentially.
Is he going to be in them, though?
He still hasn't committed.
He hasn't committed, but surely, I mean, perhaps he'll take the position that I'm so far in front, I'm not going to commit to one of these TV debates.
The TV debate is for the other six to decide who's going to go up against him in the final round.
Yeah.
And essentially then, is what he would, that's how he would frame it.
And then it's all for the benefit of just a few hundred thousand Tory party members.
170,000
old white
men.
Who will get to decide.
Mainly old white men, 97% white.
It's a bit like having a televised debate to see who will be the next Chelsea manager or something. Because it'll only be decided by a very small number of people in a boardroom.
Yes. And I think that's absolutely right. It does seem a bit ridiculous. But hey, I guess we get to see them all try out whatever lines. Essentially, it's all about Brexit, isn't it? This whole Tory party leadership about who takes the hardest line on Brexit.
Who's the most or least Brexit it'll
be. And then they can decide which way they want to go. But they'll go right, won't they? Because otherwise they're not going to get Farage's, whatever it is, 3 million back from the Brexit Party. I mean, they have to.
I was reading before I came in, I was reading, who stands for what on Brexit. And that seems to be the sort of main catalyst is, how no deal are you? Loads of them are sort of, you know, some are trying to take the soft line. I think Rory Stewart was like, I want to reopen the negotiation. And it's like, reopen what? You've been told time and time again by the EU that they're not going to reopen it. So what are you going to reopen exactly?
Like I say, the Brexit Party has taken quite a few votes off them and they have to get them back. Otherwise, they've got no chance of winning the election. And so, therefore, hard Brexit is probably what it's going to be. And Boris is saying, well, Dominic Raab is the other one who's saying that, isn't he? I mean, I think the rest of them are different lines. Anyway, the point is Boris our Trump?
Yeah.
Is he essentially our Trump? Just a guy just full of bluster?
There's an element of that. I think he's certainly a bit more refined than Trump. There won't be sort of Twitter spats. There won't be any grabbing by the X, Y and Z. But I think that there is an element of this guy could put his foot in his mouth, but he was Foreign Secretary. He has had cabinet positions before. He's well liked in certain other parts of the world. He was successful in certain countries he went to visit, and he did come across well. He was lampooned in France. He was lampooned in America.
Are you saying that it might not be the disaster that some people are saying it's going to be?
I'm very anti most of the political movements that have happened in the last sort of year. 2 years, but I mean, going back to Trump, we talk about what an absolute disaster Trump was. But when Trump got in, it was he's going to blow the world up, he's going to have the nuclear codes,
and we're still here.
And a few years later, we're still here, and he hasn't gone to war with anybody. And apart from all of the dreadful social media pronouncements, it's not been that spectacularly bad for most of the world.
We have better checks and balances than the US has.
They've got Congress and the Senate. I understand the point you're making. That was really the one consolation I had when Trump got in the way that Obama was not as great as we were hoping he was going to be. Mm. Trump perhaps was not as terrible as we feared he was going to be. And maybe you could say the same about Boris. It's not cut and dried by any means, but Boris is certainly the favourite. And the members, if he gets to the final two, the members love him. They do, because when they had the Tory party conference last year, and he was banned, wasn't he, from the main hall, and he did a side event, and he got more than anyone did in the main hall. I mean, he is box office for them. There's no doubt. So we'll see how that goes. We're going to have a new prime minister in about the next 3 weeks, aren't we? Something like that.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm very
crazy.
Excited. What else have you got, Andy?
Latest on Joe Brand.
Joe Brand latest.
She'd be very disappointed at all of this coverage, I dare say. But under fire comic issues, a half-hearted apology while she was sort of escaping whilst being chased by TV cameras. Police are now probing complaint over acid throw joke. This is her saying, why throw milkshake when you throw battery acid at politicians like Nigel Farage?
You weren't
this
here
been
yesterday.
This has broadcasted on Radio 4.
What do you think about all this, Ross?
I can understand why she's saying it, because it genuinely is funny. It actually makes me laugh in an ironic way.
Yes,
well,
yes,
it actually makes me laugh in an ironic way that Farage, of all people, is getting up on his high horse about inciting violence.
There's nothing funny about throwing acid at people.
Well,
I think we can
point.
All agree that there's that nothing funny about actually throwing acid at people, but Joe Brand didn't actually throw acid at people. She made a joke about it. That's the difference,
and
I do see that
no one listening to Radio 4 is going to get up but get some battery acid and go, this is a good idea.
Do you think that's the point, isn't it? Really, that they're listening going, oh yeah, battery acid, I never thought of that. So what's the harm?
I don't think it's funny to make a joke about battery acid. What I think is ludicrous is that the police are investigating this.
It is ludicrous. The police have got better things to do. We're talking about thousands of coppers not on the beat. I said this yesterday, we can't investigate your burglary. We're looking at the Joe Brand's battery acid
joke. Enemy of the state, Joe Brand.
I tell you what, that's a joke. That, the police investigating Joe Brand's joke, is a joke.
But the fact that Farage is, you know, of the one person that probably has incited violence and, you know, on a massive scale, you know, with this hatred of anybody that doesn't fit his, like,
yeah,
views.
You do wonder what, I mean, Ross is brown, by the way, so I do wonder what brown people think of Farage and their stuff that he said over
the
years.
I despise him.
Right.
And it's because you do have morons. When Brexit came in, I was in Eastbourne, and Eastbourne was one of the places that actually voted. Well, it was tennis.
And
I was with Carthy and Nana Seagram, the BBC Sport news presenter, and we were walking down the road, and I swear to God, I've never felt so many eyes on me.
Yeah.
Because it is this old provincial town. I mean, we probably lowered the age group of Eastbourne by about 100, just being there for the week to
and
change the tennis.
The skin tone as well,
no doubt.
And that's the point,
and
isn't
that's
it, really?
The point.
Whatever Joe Brand has said about making a joke about throwing battery acid on Nigel Farage, she's never made people feel like that. She never made people feel like that. And I think we really have to get a sense of perspective about this, don't we? Except for the Sun and the Mail and the rest of the newspapers who seem to be leaning on it on the front page for 2 or 3 days in a row.
You know, the Mail have jumped the shark a bit with this when their own Richard Littlejohn is saying that this has gone too far.
Yeah.
He's saying that the police investigating it is ridiculous.
I know.
Richard Littlejohn.
Richard, don't. Let's not go there. It'll make your head explode.
This is Love Sport.
It is time for the big debate on the Comedy Breakfast on Love Sport Radio. We were chatting about this earlier. Emma Hayes wrote a piece. This is really about the fact that Emma Hayes wrote a piece in the Times about how she just wanted to make the suggestions about how to improve it. People are saying that the Women's World Cup has not been quite what it should be, and she just wanted to ask a few questions. Should they make the goal smaller? Should they make the pitch smaller? Should they make it just a bit more suited to the basic physicality that women have as opposed to men? What's your general view about this?
I think if it's something that could have been brought in from the start, and we've discussed at length about, you know, women not even being allowed to play professional football for quite some time, then I think it would have been a sort of a natural starting point. But it just feels a little bit... I think saying
after the fact.
Yeah, and I think saying improve, I want to pick up a word that you used, which is tweak. And I think that, you know, improve signifies that it isn't working at the moment, it's terrible and it needs to be fixed. Whereas I think tweak is a little less harsh, I think. It says that we're making a few adjustments to maybe bring back some of the intensity. I mean, we talked about watching Australia and Brazil.
Yeah.
And I watched them because I always consider Australia a huge sporting nation.
Yep.
Brazil and football are synonymous. And I watched maybe like the first couple of goals, and then I decided I've got to get up early, so I'm just going to go pot around and do other bits and pieces.
Watch Titanic 2
Titanic 2 on the telly, which is what you would do.
But I see that. And I watched the last 20 minutes of that game because I was in the kitchen. I was listening to Sunning. And they were talking about the fact that, there's a great game going on in the Women's World Cup. I thought, I'll have a look. Actually, it wasn't a great game. It was a bit scrappy for the last 20 minutes. That is not to do with the size of the goals or the size of the pitch. It was just a scrappy game. You get that sometimes. The Australians, by the way, were their game management was excellent in terms of killing the game, and I understand why. Tweak, you're right. Maybe use the word tweak, but I wouldn't accept the argument that you made that just because something wasn't done at the start, that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. I think you should always look at ways to tweak... I think improve is okay as a word.
Okay.
There's no side to this aside from just trying to make it a better product.
But logistically, how do you do that? Because football pitches are a size.
Well, no, they're not. First of all, football pitches they have a maximum and a minimum. You can also, by the way, you can easily paint a line on inside the other line. That's not a problem. Goals are not a problem either. You just build smaller
goals I'll give you.
And you bring them in, right? I mean, by the way, they've already... The rule in the Women's World Cup is that you can pass the ball out from the goalkeeper and you don't have to be outside the penalty area to pick the ball up. So you can just carry on playing. So that is a universal rule, and they're now bringing that in. But I'm saying that's an improvement to the game, I think, because I don't see why you should have to pass the ball out of the penalty area. Just get on with the game. I just think it's worth talking about. I think it's better that it comes from Emma Hayes than it comes from any male pundit.
Correct.
Because she is very well respected, and she doesn't want women's football. She doesn't want it to be thought of as lesser. But the prize money from FIFA for the Women's World Cup is about, 1/13 of the men's?
Yeah.
And they get about 1/5 of the audience. So there is a disparity there. But perhaps they partly get a smaller audience because the product isn't as watchable as the Men's World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. Maybe. I mean, it's difficult because I think we can both agree that when we watched England-Scotland, the intensity was every bit as much as you'd expect from any high-quality football match.
Yes, but I would have liked to have seen a stadium that was full. And I'm telling you, right, if England men are playing Scotland men, there are enough people who are making the effort to go and see that game.
Yeah.
There are thousands coming over from over here. This is in France. This is not miles away.
No.
Why aren't 30, 40,000 young women travelling to France to go and see England-Scotland play in what we admit was a very intense game? And what I'm saying is that the intensity of the product, in general, not sometimes, but in general, is not what it could be. It's not what it is in the men's game. And perhaps smaller goals, perhaps a smaller pitch, a more claustrophobic environment would improve it in that way.
Yeah,
maybe.
I definitely think the goals are an easy thing to substitute. But I don't feel that women are incapable of running up and down a full-length pitch.
No, I what, don't. I don't
let
think.
Ask you, let me ask you a question then. So the minimum size pitch, how minimum is it compared to
it's only
a normal
about 5 yards in?
It's so
only,
yeah, so yeah. So it's not bringing in a huge amount.
No, but as has been pointed out this morning, some teams like to set the pitch up wider because they like to stretch the game. Barcelona have the biggest possible pitch because they want to ping it about from wing to wing. Now, of course, women are capable of booting the ball 60 yards just like a bloke, right? There's no getting away from it. But, I mean, you used to be a hurdler, right?
Yep, I did.
Women's hurdles, they run 10 metres less than men, and they are shorter.
Yeah, the women's hurdles are 2'9" from heel to thigh for me, so it used to be to the top of my thigh.
And that's purely about physiology, right?
Yeah, I couldn't have done high hurdles if they were 3 inches taller. And I could do it as mobility for the longer hurdles because it was just about manageable to do 4 strides down all the way consistently.
Are the 400 metres hurdles, are they smaller in those?
Yeah, they're
they
3 inches smaller
there, well.
So I think it's 2'9" and 2'6".
And that's because they looked at it and went, well, women are smaller than men, so therefore we will make the hurdles smaller. If they were starting football right now, women had never played football, they go, right, what should the size of the goals be based around the size of the goalkeepers? And they would not be the size they are, right? And it's also, by the way, possible that the goals in men's football would be bigger because the goalkeepers used to be 5'9", 5'10". Now they're 6'5". It's actually incredibly hard to get it past them. So I think there are arguments to adjust the men's game as well.
Okay.
I think sometimes,
and I'll buy that.
I think sometimes with a men's game, there's not enough room on the pitch because the players, it's the same size pitch it's always been, but the players are 1,000 times fitter and there's no space.
Yeah.
So I think it's always worth looking at ways of tweaking games, which, let's be fair, they do with a back pass rule, with the offside, with the handball, to change it and make it a more intense product, which is what we want to see. This conversation will go on.
This is Love Sport.
Thanks for listening to the Ian Stone Comedy Breakfast Podcast Edition. I'm back every weekday morning, 6:30.